So, this morning, recognizing that there are many people who may have been here before, but also people that perhaps haven't done much meditation before, I thought I might give a big picture as to the context of the path and the context of some of the practices that we're going to be doing. Because sometimes we can approach meditation as though it's a series of exercises, a series of tools or techniques that we apply to our mind and we perfect or hone, and then we get the desired result. And approaching meditation in this way is a little bit limited and tends to make meditation rather difficult. And the reason for that is because we're trying to practice something that we don't really understand outside the context of the Eightfold Path, outside the context of the Buddha's teachings as a whole. And so when it becomes decontextualized in this way, it gets very reduced. And we can pick up methods and practices in the same way we pick up anything else in life, as kind of means to getting what we want. And of course, as a result, meditation becomes rather fraught and frustrating and difficult. So I wanted to talk about some of the foundations that we can develop throughout our lives, not only here, but throughout our whole lives, to help the process of meditation become natural in the way it's meant to be, and easeful, and leading from probably some suffering into ever more increasing kinds of wholesome joy, ever more refined and subtle and reliable kinds of joy. So is there anyone here who finds meditation difficult? Be honest. Sometimes. Yeah? Okay. So that's probably half of you. And the ones that don't, I mean, you can, I don't know, you could meditate anywhere, really. You can go home if you want to. But no, you'll be inspiring for the rest of us. So that's great. So let's get right back to the basics, which is sila, samadhi, and panya. Does everybody know what those things mean? Some people here? Okay, so sila is virtue. Samadhi is something like calm or stillness or serenity. So it's the mind when it starts to settle down and starts to become tranquilized, and as a result starts to energize also and become bright. And then the last one, the panya, is wisdom or insight. The ability of the mind, if you like, to be able to see deeply into things, into the nature of things. And these three work together: sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, peace, and wisdom, or virtue, stillness, and insight, if you like. And they're not necessarily separate techniques. So I was speaking about this recently at the monastery, and I said to one of the visitors that I had to teach about Samatha and Vipassana, which is the stillness and the insight. And I had to teach a community of trainee Dhamma leaders about these two things. And I said, I'm not quite sure how to differentiate them. And she said, oh, that's very easy. Samatha, which is stillness, is trying not to get bored with the breath. And Vipassana is trying not to complain about the aches and pains. And I thought that was really great and very true, actually, that that's what it is for most of us, right, in the beginning. But one of the reasons for that is because the virtue is not sufficient, is not really properly cultivated and developed in an ongoing way. And so when we come to the breath, we come to it rather soon, and as a result, it becomes a struggle. Or, as she said, very boring, right? There's nothing much to see there in the breath, and it's like, why am I doing this? I could be out on the hills. Anyway, at least it's not the snowy season, but you could be out there skiing or doing all kinds of other exciting things, right? And Vipassana, of course, if you haven't got the foundations, you just sit there and you're dealing with the pain. You're like, I'm trying to be equanimous, but really, you wish it would go away. So, fortunately, meditation is not something we're supposed to endure. The Buddha actually said that breath meditation is easy and leads to peace, leads to happiness, leads to the overcoming of, let's call them distracting thoughts, but actually any thoughts, any kind of thinking in the mind. And of course, insight cuts through the root of the problem by addressing the roots of our delusion. So the path, when taken in its proper sequence and properly understood, is a holistic, beautiful, integrated approach to meditation, and it is conditioned. So it's not something that we either can or can't do. It's not something we have an ability in or we don't have what it takes. It's something that happens when the causes are in place. But just to get back to these two qualities again as an example, is that they do have different functions in our practice. So the aspect of stillness or samadhi actually has the function of purifying what we call the emotional kind of defilements. So there's a little sutta that I jotted down, and it's in the Anguttara 2, number 3:10. If anybody's interested in getting to know the Buddha's teachings, I can write these suttas down afterwards. But I think they're really interesting. And this is one I read in Bhantisarjato's book called The Swift Pair of Messengers. And here it was to talk about how Samatha and Vipassana work together in harmony but have specific purifying effects. So it says here that when samatha, when calm is developed, the mind is developed. And when the mind is developed, it has the purpose of abandoning craving. Okay, so craving, Bhantisarjato was saying, is a kind of emotional, I don't like the word defilement, but kind of affliction, let's say. Yeah, it's something that's arising in the emotional world. And when vipassana or insight is developed, understanding is developed. When understanding is developed, it has the purpose or the function to abandon delusion, which is a distortion of the cognitive process. So these two things work together. One is maybe more emotional, one is maybe more, it's not really entirely cognitive, but it's to do with view, the way we view the world and the distortions of our perception. So we don't really see things as they are when delusion is distorting the truth. So the journey, and I've noticed this myself, I started out in my practice with a lot of insight meditation, so-called Vipassana techniques. But along with that, there was a lot of calming of the mind that came as a result, because I would be understanding the workings of the mind and as a result see how these hindrances were working, were operating, were caused. And the mind would get increasingly settled on its object. But when I kind of went more to emphasizing the samadhi practice, the stilling of the mind, I noticed it's really an emotional journey. So I don't know, are you prepared for an emotional journey on this retreat? Yes? Ish? It becomes quite emotional because we're actually working with to purify our emotional world. Yeah? So at first, of course, we meet things like craving, wanting, desire, maybe even lust, maybe anger, ill will, etc., drowsiness, getting bored. But over time, this starts to give way to some of the beautiful emotions, and the Buddha said that they are to be cultivated and developed. So emotions like peace. Peace is an emotion. It's a subtle and beautiful, nourishing emotion, but nevertheless, it's an emotion. Contentment is a kind of emotion, but these are the emotions that actually still the mind. So the Buddha said that both samadhi and insight is founded on a basis of virtue. Yeah, so virtue is the foundation, and that the kind of stillness that develops with virtue as a foundation is of great fruit and benefit. Yeah, I've met people in my 30-odd years of travel, of practice and travel, who have practiced a lot of maybe breath meditation or other methods to calm the mind, but they've done so with a lot of will, a lot of force, and sometimes without a proper foundation of virtue. And the result for that is that it's very fragile, very unstable, and it almost acts like a kind of covering on the mind. So you can hold things together when you've got good conditions, but as soon as you leave those conditions, there's not the foundation to sustain those deep states of mind. And it can be very damaging to people's faith because, you know, these practices, when properly, when coming as part of the path, lead to a reduction in craving, in greed, in harming, essentially. And without that proper foundation of virtue, we're still causing harm to others. And then it becomes very confusing. You know, somebody might boast about their kind of experiences in meditation, but that's not how they behave around others. They're still causing harm. As long as we're still causing harm, you know, we've got a lot of work to do. Because as I said yesterday, this practice is not just for ourselves. It's not just so we feel good on the meditation cushion, but it's rather so that we can bring more peace and harmony into the world and into the lives of those around us. So when it is founded on right view and virtue, then the practice becomes extremely powerful. So how did the Buddha talk about samadhi and insight in the context of the path? And one of the most beautiful teachings in the whole of the suttas, which is repeated again and again, is something called the gradual training. Has everybody or anybody heard of the gradual training? Yeah? So this is repeated time and again, apparently in around 40 places throughout the text. And it's very beautiful because it talks about how the path is conditioned, first by hearing the Dhamma, coming in contact with the Dhamma, which is what all of you are doing right now. And as I said, it's a very holistic path. It's also an impersonal path. You put certain causes into place and the results are going to come about, but perhaps not when you want them to. Right? Sometimes we think, okay, I've put the causes in place, now I should be getting some results, and if they're not coming, you know, maybe something's wrong. Nothing's necessarily wrong, but it may be just that the time hasn't ripened yet. There's this beautiful story in, I think it's in one of Ajahn Brahm's books, about a father and let's say his daughter, because often it's the father and the son. Let's say the father and his daughter. And his father is a farmer and wants to teach his son about the laws of farming, the laws of nature around planting seeds and fertilizing them properly, allowing them to receive the sun, receive the rain, and then gradually grow into plants and into food. So the father has cultivated this field and he takes his little son down to have a look and he says, you know, these seeds that have been planted are going to grow up into barley or whatever it is. And the son says, okay. And the father says, but you have to go out and water them every day. It's the daughter. So the daughter goes out with the watering can on the first day, waters the seeds. Daddy, nothing's happening. Just be patient, give it a bit more time. Goes out the next day, waters the plants. Still nothing's happening. But then by the third day, she gets very excited because she noticed there's the tiny little shoot sticking up from the earth. Oh, wonderful. So the father says, okay, just carry on, you know, allow the sun to come, the rain will come. Sometimes you have to water, sometimes you have to back off watering, right? We can also kill the plant if we overwater things, if we kind of try too hard and we, you know, try to bring all the conditions together with a lot of will. So, okay, she carries on. And then the little shoot turns out into a plant about this size. But by now it's been, you know, a couple of weeks at least, maybe a month, and the little girl's getting really frustrated. So she goes out one day when the father's not around and she sees these little plants and she starts to stretch them to try to make them grow faster. So she pulls the leaf and of course the plant breaks and one by one she kills all the plants. And this is what can happen in our meditation, isn't it? If we try to stretch our practice, you know, if we try to force our mind or even become kind of too perfect all at once. Maybe we think that now we've taken the precepts or now we've committed to a life of harmlessness. We have to, you know, be perfect at any cost. And I don't know about Bhante, but I've seen in monasteries that when people first come in, sometimes they're very overzealous and they want to go entirely by the book on all the nitty-gritty of, for me, it's 310 rules, for Bhante, 227. It's a lot anyway. We can't even keep count, and I'm sure we're not practicing them all the time, mainly because they don't always apply and come up in our lives. But sometimes people can get very dogmatic and start to tell everyone else what they're not doing right. And this is sometimes because we're not yet mature. We don't yet understand how to let things grow and how to allow the wisdom to gradually arise so that we can apply these things with compassion according to the situation and the context that we're in. So don't start to be control freaks around putting conditions in place. But the idea is that we put those conditions in place with a lot of love, with a lot of care, a lot of gentleness, and also enjoyment. That it's enough just to be here. It's enough just to listen to the Dhamma. Just allow it to soak in. You know, you don't have to now do anything with it. You don't have to start analyzing it or remembering which suttas were referred to or any of that. You can just allow the Dhamma, the teachings, to sink in, just like the plant allows the sunshine, you know, to shine upon it and the water to trickle down to its roots. So in a sense, we're like that little plant, you know, we're a little sapling that has enough faith in the teachings to at least stay put and allow the Dhamma to work on us, allow the path to unfold within us. And the other beautiful thing about the gradual training, as I said earlier, is that it is a gradual refinement in wholesome happiness. And Ajanito is going to talk about this some more tomorrow, about joy. But there are different kinds of joy, and the kind of joy that comes from the Buddha's teachings, that comes from things like virtue, is a very wholesome and reliable kind of joy. So let's get into the gradual training. And I didn't even think that we'd be using a projector, so I've just made some notes from the sutta. But again, I think it's nice to take this in a meditative way, and not to try and understand it intellectually, because the gradual training, in a way, is like a fleshed-out version of the Eightfold Noble Path. And it's very practical and applicable to our lives. So how does it begin? And this is really nice. The first step is that the Buddha arises in the world and teaches the Dhamma. That simple. So there has been a Buddha in our eon, or I don't know how many eons, but anyway, Buddhas arise from time to time, and it's not very often. But whether the Buddha's alive or not is quite irrelevant. You know, basically what the Buddha represents is our own capacity for awakening, our own potential for enlightenment. And as long as the teachings are alive, then the Buddha is here. The Buddha is alive because we have the opportunity to hear the Dhamma that's beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. And for me, just hearing the Dhamma was already beautiful. It was already inspiring, uplifting, and I would say kind of life-saving. In the sense that it gave me a purpose to live, it gave me a meaning to my life. And radically changed my value system, I think. Although my values were quite aligned to the Buddha's teachings, once we start to hear the Dhamma, we realize what really matters in life. You know, and so many of the kind of petty concerns that we clutter our minds up with start to fade in importance. You know, one of the first teachings that the Buddha gave was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. The bare fact that there is suffering, but that there's a cause to that suffering. It doesn't come from nowhere, there's a cause. The cause is craving, wanting things to be different. Yeah, wanting our wishes, which are sometimes impossible to fulfill, to be fulfilled. And this is one of the reasons that we suffer. There are other reasons too. And that cause and the suffering itself are to be understood. Yeah, so it's not an intellectual teaching. It's something we can experience. And it's something we can do something about. Of course, the Buddha also, fortunately, didn't pass away after teaching the first two noble truths. He continued and taught the end of suffering and the path towards that end. And so even an appreciation of these teachings starts to change us, also because he taught that suffering is universal. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, it doesn't matter if you're heterosexual, homosexual, it doesn't matter if you're black, brown, white, or any other color under the sun, it doesn't matter. Even if you're a human, you're going to suffer. Different species suffer. Wherever there's life, there'll be suffering. And so we are all in this together. And the solution is also universal. It's a universal one. So this is very beautiful. And one of the phrases that always stands out to me in this teaching is where the Buddha says, all beings desire happiness and recoil from pain. I think this is so important in today's world where this ever-increasing divide between ordinary people, let alone poor people, and people with extreme, outrageous wealth is widening. And it's been shown in social psychology that the richer and the more extreme a person's wealth, the less empathy they tend to have. Empathy tends to decrease, and there's more likelihood of narcissistic behaviors and less concern, less appreciation of other people's struggles as that gap becomes, you know, heightened and extreme. And so just to remember that no matter who we are, and sometimes especially those with a lot of power and wealth, we are suffering, you know. And the more we're disconnected from each other, the more we don't, you know, we lose that connection with our common humanity, also the more impoverished we become. The Buddha actually said contentment is the greatest wealth. Not billions and billions of dollars, but contentment. And I remember even before going to India and encountering the Buddha's teachings, I read in some glossy magazine that my mom liked to read something about contentment is the end of desire. It was just like on one page in the middle of this magazine, and it just struck me. I thought, gosh, of course, you know. If there's no desire, then how can we be discontent? How can there be any problem at all? And of course, I didn't know that was the Buddha's teaching until much later on, but that was the beginning for me, and it was such a relief. So hearing about these Four Noble Truths is not a pessimistic teaching. It's something that's highly optimistic because the Buddha's giving us a path. And the next aspect of right view is really simple also, but not necessarily something everyone takes on board, and that's that actions have effects. Has anyone not noticed that actions have effects? Okay, because in this same sutta, it's really interesting. It starts with all these different views that the teachers that were contemporary to the Buddha had. And some of those views are that there are no effects to our actions. And one of the results of that view was that they went around indiscriminately killing living beings because they felt that, well, it didn't make any difference. We're just here to kind of wield power over others, to get our desires fulfilled. And if actions don't have any effect or any consequence, what does it matter what we do? You know, a less extreme version might be, well, what does it matter what we do? Why don't we just enjoy ourselves? Why don't we just indulge in the pleasures of the senses? Or maybe another example of picking up this incorrectly is that we say, well, you know, if everybody suffers according to their karma, then just let them be, just leave them to suffer. You know, what's it got to do with me? But that's not the teachings. Our own actions have effects on ourselves, but they also have effects on other people. And so when we can develop this sense of social conscience, again, it helps us create beautiful societies where everyone's needs can be met. Yeah, where we can share the wealth in the society, like you do in Norway, actually. It's a very good example of a social democracy, hopefully continuing that way. I know that in every culture it's getting less that way, but comparatively speaking, I think Norway is doing pretty well. Finland as well. They have good education for everybody, good infrastructures in terms of healthcare and roads and things like this. So this kind of commonality, you know, understanding that we impact each other helps us to become much more careful about the way we relate. And this also is highly empowering, right? So we have the truth of suffering, which is highly inspirational and I would say a big relief. And then we have the teachings on cause and effect, which help give us a sense of agency, give us a sense of accountability, yeah, that we start to take responsibility as adults for our lives. Yeah, I'm getting 50 very soon, in just a few days, really, after this retreat, thank goodness. So I'm still in my 40s right now, but I'm starting to think, gosh, does that mean I'm an adult then? I don't know. Am I suddenly going to grow up? I'm not sure. Half a century old. Yeah, there must be other people in here that are at least half a century old. Looking at no one. But, you know, gradually we do have to learn to take responsibility and account for our actions, including the impact of our actions as well. It's not just enough to have good intentions. Sometimes we have to be careful that, okay, our intentions are good, but still the way we speak or behave can harm other people, and we can still apologize for that. It's okay to apologize, even if you weren't wrong in your intention, but it can create more harmony, more understanding between us. And then another aspect of this right view is that there are other people in this world who've helped us in our lives. So it's written down in the suttas in quite a cryptic way. It says something like, there is mother, there is father, there are recluses and Brahmins who've gone forth for the sake of ending suffering, something like this, and have realized the goal of the holy life. But what that basically means is that there are people who have enabled us to have life in this human form, and we do have a sense of gratitude, you know, and maybe if you've had a difficult upbringing, that might not immediately resonate for you. But still, you can be the cause for somebody else's thriving in this world, right? So what kind of upbringing would you have liked? And can you be a mentor or a kind of guide for someone else? You know, can you offer someone else the kind of nurture that you didn't receive? Yeah. Actually, the Buddha said that even if you carried your mother and father on your shoulders for the rest of your life, my dad's pretty tall, and my shoulder's pretty bad, that wouldn't be enough to pay back our debt of gratitude. The best way we can possibly do it is to bring them into the Dhamma. And sometimes we can't bring them on a retreat. It doesn't have to be literal, but sometimes we can develop the Dhamma in ourselves and bring ourselves to them. In other words, start to relate to them with more kindness and understanding, maybe with more forgiveness, more compassion. Sometimes I think about my parents, who were good parents, but obviously weren't perfect, as none of us are. And I realized that, gosh, when I was born, my mum was 27. It's really, really young. You know, at 27, I traveled the world and I was just about to start a degree in Indian medicine. With a view, actually, to ordaining, but I hadn't found a monastery yet. But I was young. There's no way I was ready to take on a responsibility like that. So, of course, all of us, in whatever role we're in life, are just trying our best based on the information we have, based on what we've learned from our elders, or from books, or the conditions that we've had in our lives. So we can't do it perfectly, but we can still develop gratitude. And that develops humility as well. So when we have at least this preliminary right view, this appreciation of suffering, the appreciation that actions have results, and that we didn't get here alone, we don't have our wealth or our kids or whatever other things you're grateful for in life, entirely due to our own efforts. There's been countless, countless people. Even if you think about a meal, how many hundreds of thousands of people must have been involved in bringing you that food? In enabling that food to arrive on your plate or in your bowl, you know, from the time it was planted to the time it arrives magically in the dining room at lunchtime when the gong goes, or even without the gong, it arrives. So I think what this can do is start to help us change our priorities, yeah, and also perhaps change our lifestyle to reflect that change in priorities and values that we may have. When our views change, we also arrange our lives differently. Just a very simple example, which is not a, you know, it's not necessarily one of greater ethics, but one of the people who has been staying with me for a long time now has been thinking about training with me as a nun. And for the last couple of years, I've been thinking, I really hope she does choose to stay. But I didn't want to push her, you know. I wanted to give her a lot of space and let her find her time. So I was really sort of just being encouraging, but not being particularly, I didn't want to put any pressure because it has to be the right time for someone. And in the meantime, unbeknown to me, she was thinking, well, I'd love to go forth really soon, actually. I'd love to ordain as a nun, but I don't think Venerable Chanda's ready to take me on as a trainee. And I was thinking, gosh, if someone doesn't take up the training this year, I don't know if I can keep going because I don't have any support and I have to see that this is going to bear some fruit, you know. So she had this view that I had to be a fully ordained nun for 12 years before I could ordain her as an anagarika. But actually, that's not the case. I could have ordained anyone, actually. I think even as a seminary, probably you can give 8 precepts, can't you? So a long, long time ago. And it was only when we had a conversation and she started to tell me that she was planning to go overseas for quite some time, Sri Lanka and Canada and different places. And I said, okay, well, you know, if that's what you want to do, I support you. And you know, you can always come here. And, you know, if you do choose to come and train here, then that'd be wonderful. But okay, if you want to go, you have to go. And then it came around to the point where she said, actually, I would have trained with you last year. I said, huh? So why didn't you say? And she said, but well, I didn't think you were ready. And I said, but I am ready. So are you asking to train? And then she started crying and said, yes, I'm asking to train. And it was such a beautiful moment. It was so poignant and so unexpected. But just an example of how, and a very humble and beautiful example in a way, innocent example of how when we have a certain view, we start to plan to do all these things, you know, to travel the world or to arrange our lives in one way. Whereas actually, if we had the right view or a different view that was more aligned with the way things are, we would arrange things differently. So that was a very beautiful example of a situation which actually led to somebody going forth. And this is the next part in this gradual training. So the Buddha says that as a result of learning to have values that are meaningful to us, valuing things like kindness over cruelty, valuing things like honesty over deception, valuing patience maybe over force, pushing things to happen. Because of this change in view, we start to simplify our life. And one goes forth. So in this sutta, it talks about one going forth into the homeless life as a renunciate. So they take the, I think they do say, yellow robes and go forth just with a bowl and robe. And of course, a few more things too, like a razor blade and a computer and other kind of burdens of the modern day life. But at this point, when one goes forth with understanding as to why one's going forth. They go forth not to escape from things they can't deal with in the world, but to escape to greater happiness. You know, people used to ask me, are you running away from something? And I said, no, I'm running towards something. Okay, maybe I was a bit too speedy in those days. But in a sense, we're turning away from something that no longer serves us and we're turning towards an opportunity for freedom, a path that leads to deeper freedom in our lives. So, yeah, just recently, actually, another guest asked me, how will I know when I'm ready to ordain? And I said, well, one of the main things I look for is that someone's not running away. Someone's not just trying to avoid or get away from a situation that they, you know, can't deal with for some reason, especially psychologically, like it's known as spiritual bypass, when we want to kind of jump over all the difficult things in our mind and get only onto the peace, only onto the bliss, right? And we can do that in our practice as well. But the purpose here is that the right view, the idea of suffering, changes our attitude to life and leads to us picking up a more skillful way to relate. And this is what the Buddha called the three right intentions. The intention of loving kindness rather than ill will. So that means when it comes to our minds, being able to embrace whatever's arising, including the difficult emotions, including the pains and aches in the body. You know, as Bhante Nito said last night, it's not that we sit through pain, but maybe by changing our attitude to it, we'll find it's not as painful as we think. And we can actually make peace with that pain and see it subside simply by reaching out to it with friendliness, with a caring kind of attitude. Yeah, we start to value and develop ways of relating based on compassion rather than harming. Yeah, this is called avihimsaka, non-violence. So not trying to kind of force our minds, not being self-critical in our minds. There's this thing called the inner tyrant that's often talked about in meditation circles, where we just have this negative train of thoughts that constantly put us down. You know, maybe we've heard that from other people, or maybe we've just got into a kind of pattern of self-criticism that's really harmful to ourselves. So instead we notice that and we can actually say, wow, this is painful. You know, may I be free from this suffering? May I learn to care for myself, care for my mind, and respect my mind as well. Yeah? And then we have the attitude of learning to let go rather than to grasp on to experience with a sense of ownership and control. And letting go also doesn't mean bypassing or skipping over something. It actually means more like letting things be. And the result of opening up to things the way they are and being able to stay with them, being gentle with them, is that things that are afflictive, things that do cause suffering, will gradually start to fade on their own. So we don't have to do the letting go. It can't be done. We simply have to give things space and start to understand these don't belong to us. You know, your thoughts are not your thoughts. They're just the kind of chit-chat of the mind. It's just the residue of everything that's gone in, consciously or unconsciously, from the time you were born and maybe before. So none of it belongs to us, and this makes it much, much easier to give things space. So with these right intentions, we go forth out of compassion for the world, you know, with a desire to develop ourselves in meditation, or I should say an aspiration, it's a wholesome desire, but also to do so to help other beings and to be an example that others can aspire to as well. And after going forth, one then starts to really cultivate virtue based on a life of simplicity, contentment, and restraint. And I love how virtue is described in the gradual training. It's not just a list of don'ts. It's actually a beautiful description of the positive aspects of virtue. So rather than killing living beings, we protect life. And the phrase the Buddha uses is, with rod and weapon laid aside, one abides compassionate and merciful to living beings. It's so beautiful, isn't it? So we can do this while we're on retreat. As I said yesterday, it's not enough to just not to kill. Most of you are not going to kill anything, I'm quite sure. I hope, anyway, otherwise we have to lock our doors. but can you be more kind? Can you really protect life? Can you look out for each other? You know, if you see somebody struggling, you could potentially just give them a smile and let them know you're around, or tell one of the teachers, you know, if you think somebody's struggling in some way. So really nurturing and protecting life, even the smallest life. So that means we take a lot more care, especially in places, I think in here it's quite sterile. But in England at the moment, we get little ants walking across our dhanasala and we get spiders and all kinds of lovely little things. So we have plenty of opportunity to protect life as well. And then the second one is not only not to steal, but firstly not to take what is not given, but then also to become content with what one receives, to really value and develop gratitude for the fact that you get an egg for breakfast. I don't know what else you might have had. There's a lot, actually, so it's not a good example for being content with little. But it also can mean being generous as well and sharing our resources. You know, imagine how the world would be if everybody did share in an equal way. Maybe people who earned more would actually pay more tax. Or actually, that's what the Buddha advised as well. He said that a righteous ruler would see that people don't have enough, say, cattle, and give them cattle. They would see that they don't have enough gold and give them gold. So whatever a person is lacking, we try to provide. And those who have more control, more leadership, more capacity can do that little bit more. Yeah. So always to think that whatever you're earning is for you and your family, of course, but then it's also to give to others. So to kind of pay the gift forward, pay your good fortune forward. And that's what the Buddha called brightness to brightness. You're experiencing a lot of good fortune, or maybe a little bit of good fortune, But you don't rest there. You pay it forward. You keep on creating good karma by doing that little bit more. And then the third one is not to use our sexuality in ways that harm others. So that usually means being faithful, being trustworthy, perhaps being committed, and using our sexuality in a way that expresses respect and love and care, especially for our partners, right? So on the other side, this also means, again, being trustworthy, right? So it's not enough just to abstain, but we can actually use the energies of our lives to engender trust. What's the next one is juicy. So the next one is about right speech. So it's not only not lying, which you won't be able to do anyway, hopefully, unless you get to the interviews and exaggerate a little bit. It does include exaggeration and even white lies, but not lying is only a very preliminary kind of practice of right speech. At a greater level, we're actually trying to abstain from... I always have my little acronym for this. So it's harmful speech, false speech, harmful speech, for my malicious speech, harmful speech, and gossip. Okay, so false, malicious, harmful, and gossip. And that really means any speech that is wasting people's time, that is divisive in some way, that is not for the benefit of others. It doesn't mean never criticizing another person. This is really important to say. Although we try not to criticize a person, but rather to identify behaviors that can be harmful. So rather than say, this person did this, 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 we say, you know, the speaking in a rough way is a behavior that causes harm. Something like this. We talk about the behavior, we separate it from the person as far as we can. But on the beautiful side, the Buddha said, we try to speak words that unite the divided, that bring about a sense of harmony, a sense of ease. We use our speech in a measured way, at the right time, motivated by kindness, and many other things. But speech is something we can work on, probably for the rest of our lives, because words can cause so much unnecessary harm, and so often we say something and then regret that we've done it. And by then the person may have, you know, really taken it to heart. So using our speech in skillful ways also helps to condition our mind to think in more skillful ways, right? Because as I said, the inner speech can sometimes be really harmful. But we can start to change that speech around, even in our meditation. If you see that you're thinking a thought of cruelty, then we can have a thought of compassion instead. Oh, this is painful. May I be kind to myself? Yeah? And then lastly, it's the abstinence from drink and drugs that lead to carelessness. But also this means cultivating a mind that is bright, that is clear, that is lucid, so that we really know what's going on. Yeah. And of course, you can see how sometimes we can use alcohol or drugs in ways that is for escape. And if we can avoid getting into that in the first place, it's wonderful. I was reading yesterday about someone with a really terrible methamphetamine addiction and just how it changes the brain. And even if the person wants to come out of it, it's just too late. Quite often it's too late. The family's love barely penetrates because the brain actually starts to change. And it's absolutely tragic. People, you know, lose their lives over these things. You know, it destroys families, it destroys communities. And often it's a result of some kind of trauma from the past. So if we can find other ways to deal with our traumas, with our emotions, even with our restlessness and boredom, it is very important, because once you start on that track, it can be a real downward spiral. So instead we cultivate mindfulness, brightness, and the happiness in the mind. And the Buddha said that as a result of cultivating virtue, we start to experience something he refers to as blameless bliss. Does that sound nice? Blameless bliss. You don't have to feel guilty. You don't have to feel, do I deserve it? You don't have to worry that it's going to go away. There's a kind of background happiness underneath everything. And I experienced this quite strongly in my life. Which is a good thing, because most of the time physically I feel quite exhausted and on the edge almost of burnout. So it's interesting how I've noticed in the morning meetings, we often do a little check-in. Well, we always do if I'm there. And almost every day I say that I'm exhausted, but I'm feeling happy. And it's amazing how these two things can go hand in hand. I've noticed other people in the community have started saying similar things, that I've got a bit of a headache, but I feel content. Or I feel a bit tired today, but there's a joy. There's a lightness. There's even a brightness coinciding with the tiredness. Strange, right? But one of the reasons for that is because mental happiness and physical happiness are two different things. Or let's say physical comfort are two different things. And the more we can be connected to the happiness of the mind, the goodness of our lives, the meaning, the rewards of our lives, the more we can actually bear the discomfort and do more. I'm not saying that you should kind of work yourself to burnout, but if you don't have a choice, then it's very helpful, you know, to be able to get resourced from the energies inside. So just the other day, actually, somebody said to me, is it easier for you now that you have two trainees? Because I've got two trainees, which is great. It's enough for the next few years, probably. But anyway, I'm sure I'll have more. And I thought about that question. I said, well, actually, it's not easier, but it's more rich. I feel more enriched. I feel there's more meaning in my life. There's more nourishment. And later, I was also contemplating it. And I thought that's probably related to my value system. We were talking about values coming from view. And I realized that I don't necessarily value an easy life, but I do value a beneficial or a life of service, a beneficial life or a life of service. I actually don't mind if things are hard, because my value is not for the easy life. A simple life, yes, but I think even that is different than an easy life. A simple life can be difficult, actually, to cultivate. But an easy life is not my aim. I actually want to be able to give as much as I possibly can while I'm alive, because I recognize that although it hasn't been perfect, I've had a lot of opportunities to practice, much more than many people are ever going to have. No one can go to Burma these days, for one thing, and that's a place where you can do a lot of long retreats. So the life of virtue is an incredibly rewarding and rich and beautiful life. And we can keep on cultivating it. But one sutta that also discusses this is a story about a laywoman in the Buddha's day called Vishakha. Have you heard of her? I know some of you have. And she was the foremost female lay disciple of the Buddha, who was very well practiced. I think she was a stream winner at least. I don't know if she went further than that in her life. But she was also incredibly generous. She was a patron of the Buddha, but of the whole Sangha, so all the monks and nuns. And one year when the monks and nuns were coming to dwell, I think in Sarvati, but I haven't had a chance to check, they were coming for their rains retreat, and there were a lot of monks and nuns. And she said, can you give me the honour, the sole honour of being the one to provide all the medicine, the bathing robes and new robes if they need them, the first meal when they arrive, and the last meal when they leave? And the Buddha said, well, no one's ever asked me that before. Why should I give that to one person? Why shouldn't I share that with many people? Maybe many people would like that opportunity to give. And she was very clever, and she said, because if you give that to me, I will reflect that if any of those monks and nuns start experiencing jhanas, deep meditation, deep stillness, or enlightenment experiences, I will know that I have given them medicine, or I have given them a meal, or I've given them a bathing cloth during the time that they were here, or I fed them before they were about to leave. And when I reflect on that, I'll be so happy that gladness will arise. That's called pamoja, which is a kind of joy based on virtue. Because of that gladness that arises, I will experience piti, which is like the rapture that can come up in our meditation. You may have already started experiencing a sense of very mild or maybe intense, who knows, happiness that can arise once we do get content with that single breath, There's a kind of relief, and then there's a joy that starts bubbling up in the mind. It can feel very quiet at first, but then it increases and expands and ends up filling the mind. So this piti will arise, and as a result of that, the mind will become tranquil, the body will become tranquil, and I will be able to develop this deep inner happiness that leads to stillness, as a result of which I'll be able to see things as they really are. So this is a very deep teaching and a very beautiful explanation of the subjective experience of meditation based on Sila. And she did this through reflecting on her virtue, reflecting on the benefit of her virtue and how she'd helped other people or how she could be helping other people. Even just talking like that made her happy, right? And made it possible to get into deep meditation. So you can see how virtue has that knock-on effect. It starts to undermine the hindrances, which is the next stage in the gradual training. And it starts to generate this beautiful happiness in the mind that's based on wholesomeness. It's called niramisa sukha, pure or pure happiness, or the happiness that's not dependent on sensuality, that's not dependent on the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. This is the happiness of the mind. So with this virtue established, we also learn to guard our senses. We also learn to use our senses in a way that further generates wholesome states of mind. Last year, I gave a whole talk on sense restraint, so I'm not going to talk about it in detail now because it would take too long. But basically, we start to develop more mindfulness to be able to notice when and how the impressions of the senses are leading to unwholesome states or leading to wholesome states. So we start to try and look at things in a way that leads to wholesome states. So I can look at one of you and I can see the things that irritate me about you, even though I can't see that in anyone here. Or I can look at you and see your sincerity, your integrity, you know, the beauty on your face as you sit in meditation, the kindness with which you give us water, you know, at the beginning of the talk. And that's a kind of sense restraint. I'm using my senses in a way that uplifts the mind. So we start to see how to do this, and we develop contentment. And then the Buddha says, with this noble aggregate of virtue, sense restraint, and contentment, and mindfulness as well, then one goes to a secluded place and sits down cross-legged, ready to meditate. So hopefully you've done a little bit of that before you got here, because now you're in that secluded place. Now you have the chance to sit down, cross your legs or not, lie down, sit on a chair and meditate. And because you've been practicing already, there will be mindfulness. There'll be some amount of mindfulness. You'll be able to be in the present moment. Because you've been developing contentment already, there will be some ability to stay in that present moment without the hindrances of craving and desire blowing you away. Yeah, those hindrances are like winds that blow the mind away from the moment and into the future or back into the past. But if we have contentment based on virtue, then already the hindrances are largely overcome. And then we get around to abandoning them completely. And again, the Buddha has a beautiful description for this. He says, just as one in debt pays back their debt, in the same way one is free from craving. Just as a sick person is cured, in the same way one is free from ill will. Just as a prisoner is released, one is free from drowsiness and sleepiness. What are the other ones? Just like a slave is free, one is free from restlessness. We're like slaves to our restlessness. It's dragging us here, dragging us there. And just as a traveler who has been lost in the desert finds safety, we're free from doubt, doubt regarding wholesome states. And it's when these hindrances are overcome, abandoned temporarily for now, that we have an opportunity to experience deep meditation. And these are the deep states called jhanas, which we'll be talking about more and more in this retreat. So the hindrances are really the obstacle to those jhanas. And as you can see, you know, that the hindrances are so close to the breakages in virtue, aren't they? You know, the ill will, comes from not having enough kindness, right? So I do want to wrap up pretty quickly, but just to say that these kind of happinesses of deep meditation are not to be feared. The Buddha said that these are to actually be cultivated and developed because they're born of very virtuous states of mind. He called them the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of letting go, the bliss of seclusion from unwholesome states, but also seclusion from the five sense world. The bliss of peace, again, peace is a kind of bliss. And the bliss of enlightenment, because it's leading to enlightenment, not that it's enlightenment itself yet, but it's leading that way. So I just want to finish up today by reading you one little more simile from this same sutta. The main sutta that I've been referring to so far is Digha Nikaya number 2. It's called the Samanyapala Sutta. So anyone that wants to check it out later can do that. But the beautiful thing here is how it relates to insight. Because here the Buddha's saying that based on that stillness, based on that samadhi, the mind becomes purified and bright, rid of blemishes, soft, workable, and steady. I really love these words, soft and workable. It's like you now have something very malleable, like liquid gold in your hands, and you can really shape it into whatever you wish. And it's not just for the sake of enjoying the pleasures of these states, it's for the sake of insight as well. So the Buddha said that the one then bends and inclines their mind to knowledge and vision. And this is where it circles right back to the beginning of the gradual training. Because we've heard the Dhamma, because we've heard the teachings of the Buddha and got confidence in those teachings will now come up in our mind and they will inform the way that we view things. So the mind is very malleable, very workable, and it's capable of actually penetrating things like impermanence, suffering, and non-self. So those teachings will arise in the mind and we'll be able to see them very, very clearly because finally the mind is still. So here the Buddha says that one sees the nature of the body as conditioned and impermanent. We have insight into the nature of the mind. And all of these are resulting from samadhi. And the simile he uses is very beautiful. Just as if there were a mountain pool, crystal clear and clean, a person with good sight, standing on the banks, would see the rocks, pebbles, shells and fish. I think it says the fish lying down or swimming around. So you even see the fish having a nap. But that's not the main purpose. So one knows, in the same way one knows, the mind is now liberated from all craving, aversion, and delusion. Basically, this means that one sees the nature of the mind. One sees the liberation of the mind to whatever extent you see it at that time. Yeah? The mountain pool, crystal clear and clean. So this is a simile for the mind in deep meditation. It's crystal clear from the hindrances. It's clean of the hindrances. And then a person with good sight, that means a person who already has some insight, right? These things don't come afterwards. They come alongside. They grow together with the samadhi. So that person with good sight, standing on the banks, will see everything. They'll see the water, but they'll also see deep inside that water, right to the bottom of the lake. And they'll be able to understand exactly how suffering arises and suffering ceases. And this is how the practice works in such a beautiful, holistic way. So the practices we're going to do are skillful means, the breath meditation, metta meditation, maybe body contemplation, maybe some of your own types of meditation. They are methods, they are means, but in every meditation we need to be developing both stillness and insight. The two go together, the two inform each other and guide each other, so that where we see the obstacles, wisdom understands what to do, and the mind goes to a newer level of stillness. From that stillness you see more clearly, and that guides the mind into deeper bliss. And this is all founded on virtue. Without virtue, it won't be very lasting. It won't be very deep. So keep on developing all aspects of the training. And then every single moment is a moment of freedom. It's a moment that you are putting one more step on the path, putting one more drop of water in the jar. And drop by drop, that jar will get full and eventually overflow. So this is my talk for you this morning.